you for downloading this podcast from RNIB Connect Radio. Bruce Horak plays Chief Engineer Hemmer of the USS Enterprise in the new series Star Trek Strange New Worlds, available in the UK on Paramount+. This interview was initially broadcast in three separate parts. In part one, Bruce tells me about losing his vision at a very young age to cancer, how his family fought to save his remaining sight, and attending mainstream school in Canada. In part two, we talk about the play that inspired him to write and perform, how he rejected and then embraced a white cane, and how he became a portrait painter. And in the final part, Bruce will talk about his role in Star Trek, the makeup process, his digitally enhanced eyes, and how it felt to step onto the bridge of the Enterprise for the first time. So here's parts 1, 2 and 3 of my interview with Bruce Horak. And stick around at the end, as Bruce also gives us the books of his life. Bruce Horak is an artist, creator, performer, director, writer, improviser, guitarist, singer, songwriter, and also the first legally blind actor to appear in a Star Trek series. Star Trek Strange New Worlds is now available in the UK with Paramount+, and I'm delighted to say that the genius Chief Engineer Hemmer of the USS Enterprise joins me now. Bruce, how are you?
That is a fantastic intro. Thank you for that. It's really nice to be here. It's nice to chat with you today, Robert.
Now, we're on the radio station of RNIB. So first of all, tell us, what is your sight condition?
Well, I'm legally blind, so I have about 9% vision. I lost my right eye to cancer when I was about 18 months of age, and my left eye, there were three tumors on the retina, which were blasted with radiation. Scar tissue developed over my retina, and there's just a little window in the middle of my retina through which I see. So it's like looking down a straw, basically. So my visual field is quite narrow, and then my acuity was heavily affected when I had a cataract at about 4.5 years of age. So they did cataract surgery. So, you know, it's about 9%. It's, I see a lot of flashing, sort of vibrating fields and a lot of floaters. And it's been my normal since I was, you know, preschool, basically. So I've had this condition my whole life.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard from people who lost their sight at a young age, it affected their family much more than them. They kind of just got on with it, but their family were quite badly affected.
This is true. So the cancer that I had is retinoblastoma, which is a genetic form. And my father had it in one eye, and he had one eye removed when he was very young. They caught it quite quickly. But back in those days, you just didn't say the word cancer. And so when he was growing up, he would ask his parents, like, well, how did I lose my eye? And they would say, oh, you were sick. It was a virus. So flash forward years later, my dad gets married. He's got sons. He's got three sons, and his wife is, my mom is pregnant with me, and I'm born, and they discover this bilateral retinoblastoma, both eyes. And they asked my dad, the doctor asked my father, how did you lose your eyesight? How did you lose your one eye? And dad said, oh, I was sick as a kid. So they did a little bit more research, and they discovered that dad had retinoblastoma, and it's a genetic form of cancer. And he, you know, they understood at that time, anyway, this was 1974, 75, they understood this, that in the genetic form of cancer, if you have it, the likelihood of you passing it on to your offspring is quite high. In fact, he was told it was 1 in 4. So I was the fourth of the boys, and there I was, bilateral retinoblastoma, and it devastated him. He thought, oh, I should never have had kids. I never should have gotten married. This is awful. Like, imagine they're going to take both of his eyes, because that was the treatment at the time, was that the cancer potentially could go up the optic nerve to the brain. So they were going to remove both my eyes. And after an incredible amount of soul searching, you know, dad kind of stood up and said, we've got to find some way to save some of his eyesight, any of it at all. And the mom took me in to see the doctor again, and the doctor in Calgary, Alberta, which was where I was born and raised, said he'd heard about a treatment. There are some doctors in Toronto who were trying radiation on these tumors, and maybe we can get Bruce in to see one of these specialists. And mom just said, you call him right now. She's sitting in the doctor's office, like, we're not waiting. I will pay for this long distance call. You get on the phone right now. And so Dr. Krebs picked up the phone and called Toronto. And the next thing you know, I'm on a plane to Toronto, Ontario to have this radical treatment done. The bond between my father and I was, it was very, very deep, and it stemmed a lot from that, I think. You know, I learned that story when I was quite young. And so, you know, immediately you have an affinity, but also an incredible, you know, he was my hero. He was, and my parents were my heroes, and my older brothers too. I mean, they looked after me in incredible ways, and they, you know, they challenged me too. They didn't just let me kind of tag along and protect me at all times. They would, you know, they taught me how to ride a bicycle. They taught me to play soccer. I was a goaltender, football, I should say. And it made perfect sense. All I could see was the ball. It was like, look, I would just focus on the ball. And if it was coming towards me, I'd get in the way, you know? I think the family bond, you know, and to this day, in my career as an artist, they've just had my back all the way through. So I think if anything, I was really, really lucky to have such a, and continue to be lucky to have such an incredibly supportive family.
Did you actually go to a special school?
I did not go to a special school. It was early 80s. And, you know, there was some discussion of it, I believe, that there was a school in Brantford, Ontario. So I would have had to have been shipped off and lived in a dormitory for the year, basically, to go to the school for the blind. But, you know, I had enough vision to get away with it. you know, there were accommodations made, I think, in the early days where I would sit, you know, the first desk, you know, whatever, 6 feet away from the chalkboard. And I would have to get out of my desk and walk up to the chalkboard and read what was on the board and then go and sit back down and copy into my notes and that sort of thing. But as the years went by, there was more adaptive technology that was coming into play. So I was able to keep up. I had a little telescope so I could read the chalkboard. If there was an extensive amount of notes that I would have to copy, I would get those in advance. I learned to type, which was huge. I mean, this was 1983 and I was typing like a fiend. So I was able to keep up with note taking. And, you know, ultimately when the computer came in, I was steps ahead in that regard. So for me, school was, it was an exercise in adaptation. I learned pretty early on that this is a sighted world and you got to figure out how to work within it. And that meant asking for help. And sometimes that help came in the form of, you know, an itinerant teacher or, a special session after class, or there was that technology. And now, I mean, my goodness, the technology is remarkable. The GPS is my best friend.
Do you use Braille at all?
No, I didn't. I didn't ever learn to read Braille. I sort of took it on myself to learn the alphabet. I found it absolutely fascinating. But I started playing guitar, and I got these huge calluses on my fingers. So I can't even read the little bumps.
Now, talking of school, tell us about Zeke and the indoor plants.
Ah, Zeke and the Indoor Plants. This was a play that came to my school when I was in elementary, probably grade 3, maybe grade 4. And they trundled the whole class off to the gymnasium, and there was this production of a play. And I was so inspired by that. I immediately started writing stories and plays that I thought I would want to see performed, you know, stories that I wanted to tell and things that inspired me and, you know, made my brothers laugh and things like that. And then years later, I met the director of that show, and we really hit it off. And he has a company in Calgary called Quest Theater, which tours theater for young audiences. And he cast me in a show, first of all, to tour. And so we would be going around to the gymnasiums at 7:30 in the morning and setting up the set and doing performances and then packing it up and going for lunch and off to the next show kind of experience. I did that for about 6 months. And eventually, this was Duval Lang, is his name. He said, so what have you got? Have you got a story? And I said, I think I got a play for you. And I wrote a piece for Quest Theater called What You Can't See. And in it, it's semi-autobiographical. There's a young man, a young boy named Lee, who is 12 years old, and he's just moved to a new school. His family has just moved in, and he's visually impaired. and has to wear heavy Coke bottle glasses like I did and do. And he's very concerned that if the other kids find out that he's visually impaired, that he's going to be ostracized. And so he decides to tell all sorts of stories about his special glasses and all of his abilities and kind of gets into trouble that way. And that was, you know, that's going down the road of my creating works of art, theater, etc. That was really coming from that experience that I'd had, semi-autobiographical, but tempered by the MO of Quest Theater, which is, you know, reflecting these kids and their lives back to them.
So the acting came well before you started painting.
Well, I come from a very artistic family, so I was painting when I was really young. Dad was an amateur cartoonist. And it was always like, and he was a high school English teacher, so he'd have stacks and stacks of old papers that he didn't need anymore. So we always had something to draw on. And from the time I was really young, I was drawing comic books and always doodling. I mean, I think in a way it detracted from my education because I often found it more entertaining to draw what the teacher was talking about than have to take the notes. Anyway, I was always drawing and painting. And when I went through high school, there was a limitation that were put on the options that you could take in school. So I had to drop music when I went into grade 10. I had to drop art class in grade 11. And then I eventually just focused on theater. But I came back to painting years later, you know, again, always doodling and whatever. But I started to take it seriously in 2011 when a friend of mine saw me with a white cane for the first time. I had rejected the cane. I think this is probably something many of your listeners might relate to, is there's a bit of a reluctance when it comes to using a cane. I hear it time and time again from my visually impaired friends that they don't want to use it. And I did not want to. I thought it was going to make me a target. I thought it was going to just get in the way, that I would get all this gross sympathy, you know, that, and I really rejected it for a long time. And I can't remember exactly what year it was, but I was in Toronto and my agent called me and said that they were casting a movie. They were looking for a blind actor. And my agent said, the problem is you don't look blind enough. And I said, okay, well, I'll go get a white cane. So I went to the CNIB in Toronto. I've been a client with them since I was, you know, 5 years old, but I went in and I asked them, like, can I get a white cane? And he says, oh yeah, you've been a client. And he says, the first one's free, but you have to have mobility training. So I, a couple of days later, I took my white cane home and this young woman showed up at my apartment. I was living on a very busy street in Toronto, and she showed me how to use the cane, and we went out onto Yonge Street, and it was life-changing. Like, I could walk upright, I could have my shoulders back and my head up, and I could just move up the street, and the cane became the peripheral vision that I don't have. So instead of having to stare at the sidewalk and figure out where I'm going, it's like, oh, I could look up and just let the cane do the work. And there were people leaping out of my way. And I remember, you know, going to cross through a crosswalk, and a car had pulled it into the crosswalk, kind of trying to make a quick right turn. And, you know, all the pedestrians were having to walk around this truck and getting into traffic. And it was just a real mess. And as the guy looked over and saw me with my white cane, he backed up. And it felt like I was moving this massive truck with my cane. It was just like a wave of the magic wand. So I started to use the cane, and it became incredibly helpful. Just remarkable. And a friend of mine saw me on stage one night doing my regular show, la 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 la, and I come off stage and I've got the white cane, and he says, what happened? Like, did you lose your eyesight? What's going on? Or is that a prop? Are you working on a role or something? And I said, you know, here's my story. And I told him the whole story and how this had all happened. And he had gone to school with me. He had no idea, because I had adapted not surreptitiously, but it had just become so integrated into the way that I worked that he had no idea that I only have 9% eyesight. So we got chatting about it pretty seriously. And my friend Brandon's wife is an artist, and she does a lot of painting, and she was working on this new stuff. And we got talking about painting, and I said, oh yeah, I've done some drawing and I've done that. And I said, why don't I try to do a portrait of you the way that I see you? So we sat for an hour and a half, and we just connected in a way that we hadn't done for years. And I was seeing him through my eye instead of trying to figure out how other people see and adapt. It was, no, I'm going to sit and I'm going to look through my 9% vision. And instead of trying to ignore the floaters and all the flashing stuff and the auras that I see, I'm going to start with what I see. And that session just completely changed my life. Oddly enough, while we were sitting chatting, he was on his phone and kind of texting with his wife, and she was preparing a submission for an art show. They were looking for portraiture. And so Brandon said, you should submit. And the criteria was you had to submit 12 photos of your work. And it was due in about a month and a half or 2 months or so. So I put a call out and I said, I need 12 people to sit for portraits and I'm going to try to do this thing. And I was book solid. I had 30 portraits and then I just kept going and going and going. And I did 365 in a year. And that submission that I put together for the Harbourfront Center in Toronto was my very first showing. And it was part of a series called Likeness. And it was a series of portraits. And so that was my very first showing. That was really something. And then I got invited to do an installation with a group of artists in Kelowna, BC. And that was called Just Imagine, which Ruth Bieber, who is an incredible visual artist and activist and theater practitioner, and she actually taught me like one of my very first improv classes at the CNIB back when I was just a gaffer. She put together a show called Just Imagine, and there was myself and three other artists who are blind or visually impaired. Busser Howell from New York, PJ Lockhart from Kelowna, and Erica Watanabe from Germany, and myself. And this was my very first exposure to the Disability Arts Network in Canada, which I think I'd heard about on the periphery, but had never really connected with. And it was, again, this life-changing experience. At that point, I had done, I think, probably about 300, maybe 400 portraits. So the installation in Kelowna was 200 of my 8x10 portraits all in one tight grid. It was a dream. It was a dream that I didn't realize I'd had, you know, when you sort of step into a moment and it's like, oh, I've been here before. Maybe I dreamt this, or there was that feeling of deja vu and standing in front of all these pictures. And I realized it's because I know every single person on that wall. It's a yearbook where you know everyone. It was that feeling of deja vu. It was a feeling that I had been there before because I knew every single face on that wall and I'd spent a quality hour, at least maybe 2 hours with them.
And you took that one stage further in Assassinating Thompson, where you paint the entire audience.
Yes. Yeah. I just love painting portraits, and I love the conversation that happens and the moments of connection that happen in a portrait sitting. And that eventually developed into a solo show called Assassinating Thompson, where I stand on stage with a big canvas and a bunch of paint on a drop cloth to protect my lovely stages, and I paint a portrait of the entire audience. And as I paint, I tell the story of how I became a visually impaired visual artist, how, you know, these questions and answers and the conversations and portraits came about. And I also solve the mystery of who killed Tom Thompson. Tom Thompson was a very prolific landscape painter who died mysteriously in 1917. He went out fishing one day and disappeared, and then his body surfaced in the lake, and there was all sorts of mystery. There was fishing wire wrapped around his ankle, and there was a gash on the side of his head, and all the speculation about whether or not he may or may not have been murdered. And his notoriety has increased over time. He's considered up there, like really like significant Canadian painter. From his work, the Group of Seven started. They were all friends, and the Group of Seven always showed with Tom Thompson's work. And Lauren Harris was one that came out of that. I think Steve Martin recently did like a big retrospective on Lauren Harris's work, which is again giving some of these Canadian artists international recognition.
So that's a combination of your painting and your acting together on stage.
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of everything that I love to do all in one show. And at the end of the performance, after I kind of wrap all the loose ends up and solve the mystery for us all, I reveal the painting. And then we do a live auction, and the painting goes to the highest bidder, and the proceeds from that go to a local charity.
In your acting career, in Star Trek, we've had Geordi played by LeVar Burton and Martok played by J.J. Hertzler, both visually impaired, played by sighted actors. But you're a visually impaired actor. You must have played sighted characters before.
Yeah. Oftentimes, it's not even mentioned in the character description. So, you know, it's just an assumption that the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz has two working eyes. But when I was cast as a Scarecrow, I would jokingly say, well, my Scarecrow is visually impaired, but he's also a really good actor. So you'll never know. I'd say for the most part, I've played fully sighted people. I think, when I do tend to play the visually impaired, it's a character that I've written.
In your email newsletter, the Hobo Sapien Chronicles, a year and a bit ago, you started mentioning you're rewatching Voyager and Deep Space Nine. Did mm-hmm. you know the part of Hemmer was coming?
Yeah, I sure did. I wasn't able to talk about any of it because even with the first audition, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA. So I had gone back very early on in the process, pretty much after I had gotten just the sides and the audition and read that he was an Enar. I went back and dug into Enterprise to get some feel as to what these characters were like. And honestly, as soon as I went back through Enterprise, I'm like, oh, I love this show. And there's stuff I haven't actually watched before. Like, I don't think I had ever watched Voyager all the way to the end. And I mean, it really rekindled my love of Star Trek. You know, it had always been in the background, but going back and the fact that we can binge them all now, we don't have to wait a week for the reruns to come out or even a day. You can get through it all pretty quickly. And it's really become the forefront of my world right now, that's for sure.
As I say, we have had blind characters in Star Trek before, but you're the first actor with a visual impairment in a lead role. Was that a deliberate choice by the producers to find a blind actor?
Oh, yeah. In the call, in the sheet, the breakdown, it was very specific that they were looking for a blind or visually impaired actor to portray the role of a blind alien. And I think that was my first indication that, oh, I think they're bringing in the Enar, which was very exciting. But yeah, very, very deliberate choice. And honestly, right from the very start, the discussion around it was so open, which I so appreciated. I didn't have to bring it up, you know, and there's been so many times in my career where I have to have that moment of, okay, now I've got to disclose that I'm visually impaired and this is what I need. And like, you know, that feeling of, I don't know if it's embarrassment, but you know, it's kind of the first one out of the chute, as it were. And in Star Trek, it was just, this is a part of our conversation and I don't have to bring it up and I don't have to be the one that people are coming and saying, can I help you with this? Is there anything that you might, and even being able to spot certain things going on to set that, that I hadn't even, obviously hadn't seen, but I had assistants with me every day that I was on set from moment one of getting out of the car to getting back in the car at the end of the day. 14 hours later, there was somebody with me just letting me know what the next thing is or where cables are or, okay, they've spun the camera around this way. There was even a couple of days where one of my assistants would say, oh, it's six steps to here. Like they'd been counting my steps for me, which is, I mean, that's above and beyond, really. It's great. It's great.
Now, the Enar are an offshoot of the Andorian race, fully antennaed, fully, what I'm asking is, how long does the makeup take?
It's a lot of makeup, yeah. It takes 3.5 hours. So there are 15 individual pieces that get glued onto my face and hands. There are two technicians that work with me. Primarily, it was Alan Cook and Shane Zander, who are just these extraordinary prosthetic artists. So they work straight through for 3.5 hours. I sit in a big old comfy chair and lean my head back like I'm going to the spa, and they just glue this stuff on, and then they have to paint it all and get the shadows and the highlights just right. And then one or both of them are with me through the entire day when we're on set to do all the touch-ups on the makeup, etc. So at the end of the day, it then takes another full hour to get all of the glue off and all the pieces off and all the makeup off as well.
Are you wearing contacts as well?
I'm not wearing contacts. Initially, the design was calling for that. And what you'll usually see on the Star Trek shows is there's actors wearing contact lenses. We went to see a eye specialist in Toronto who tried on one of these lenses and probably could have worked with it. But the real issue is that because of the makeup and the prosthetics on my hands, I wouldn't be able to put the lens in myself or take it out myself. And that was just really distressing. And so the doctor said, look, you know, you've got 9% eyesight. We got to save what we can here. Let's not mess around with it. And production just said, no problem. And what you see now are digitally altered eyes on me.
Ah, right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they went through like frame by frame and milked my eyes out, which was incredible because on set, it was just my eyes under there. But what they did in post is absolutely phenomenal.
3 hours in the makeup chair. Is that why Hemmer's so grumpy?
Yeah. might be. I mean, he's written a bit crusty. And when I had the auditions, I mean, we kind of talked about the first season and about the character and kind of his role on the ship and the approach that they were looking for. And, you know, I threw a couple of different versions on the Zoom auditions just to play with it a bit. And yeah, it was a conversation of, yeah, we like this character. This is kind of, it's a good place to start because then he's got somewhere to go.
Hemmer described himself as an active pacifist.
Yeah. So the Enar are known as pacifists. And at one point Uhura kind of questions him about being a pacifist in Starfleet. And his description of it is really interesting. And something that I really connected with and that pacifism is not passivity. It is the active protection of all living things in the known universe. And I think pacifism often gets disregarded as just being, oh, you're just going to sit back and watch and not do anything. But what he's saying, to me anyway, is that there are other options in any situation and that violence is not an option. If you take that off the table, if you take off that fight, then you got to look at the other options really seriously and actually consider them. Because there's not just one way or another. There's generally a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. I mean, some of them would be absurd, but you know, they're out there as well. And I think it's significant that someone who has that as a core motto is the engineer, is the person that's actually moving the USS Enterprise through space. And, you know, following on Roddenberry's vision of what Star Trek was to be, he was like, no, it's not a military organization. They're explorers. They are building relationships and they're building a federation and working together and finding other options. And that, you know, kind of the notion of the one who throws the first punch loses. And I think we see that a lot in this particular series and Strange New Worlds is a real dedication to, we're going to find another way. And I find that really hopeful.
Now, big picture, as Bruce Horak, what's it like putting on the uniform and being on the USS Enterprise?
Oh, I wept. It was just from the very first day with the first costume fitting. And it was just, you know, it was just a red shirt and a pair of black pants with pins all over it. And as I put that on, I'm like, oh my God, it's happening. But every day was adding another piece, adding another layer. And then my first camera test was in full prosthetics, in costume. And they walked me out onto the bridge of the Enterprise and put about 30 cameras on me and I said, say something. And I just went, I got nothing. I was really fortunate to go down to the premiere in New York and I had my first like rush of fans coming over, trying to get autographs and selfies. And that was just so wild. I mean, it felt like a moment where I'd really just, I'm in the universe now. I mean, we'd spent a year working on the show and it was going to be, you know, another few weeks until we'd actually see the thing. And it felt like we'd been on pause a little bit. And as a theater performer, I'm so used to immediate response and immediate sort of, you know, standing ovation, if you're lucky, or unless it's just standing to get out. But this was like a connection with the audience and What a thrill. What a thrill.
Thanks once again to Bruce Horak. But that's not all. For the show Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio, Bruce also gave me the books of his life. Now, is there a book from your childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Book from my childhood would be The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And it was just such a delightful adventure. And to this day, I mean, I ended up just falling in love with L. Frank Baum and the whole series that he wrote. I think my favorite in that series, I mean, I go back to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz because I do read that book again and again. But my favorite in that series was The Scarecrow of Oz. Had this sort of wonderful, whimsical adventure story. And there was a character in there called the Bumpy Man who was all covered with bumps. And each one of his bumps would tell him the weather, which I thought was hilarious. And he lived on a popcorn island. No, it was a mountaintop. It was a mountaintop.
Dorothy lived in the midst of the great Kansas prairies with Uncle Henry, who was a farmer, and Aunt Em, who was the farmer's wife. The house was small, for the lumber to build it had to be carried by wagon many miles. There were four walls, a floor, and a roof, which made one room, and this room contained a rusty-looking cooking stove, a cupboard for the dishes, a table, three or four chairs, and the beds. Uncle Henry and Aunt Em had a big bed in one corner, and Dorothy, a little bed in another corner. There was no garret at all, and no cellar, except a small hole dug in the ground, called a cyclone cellar, where the family could go in case one of those great whirlwinds arose, mighty enough to crush any building in its path.
Gabriel Wolf reading from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by Frank L. Baum. Available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book that you go back to again and again on a rainy day?
Yes, it's Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury. I love that book. I love that book. Yeah, it's just a wonderful adventure through. Well, it seems to be a common theme for my favorite books, but another wonderful adventure through childhood. But sort of strained through kind of a Twilight Zone episode.
The seller of lightning rods arrived just ahead of the storm. He came along the street of Greentown, Illinois, in the late cloudy October day, sneaking glances over his shoulder. Somewhere not so far back, vast lightning stomped the earth. Somewhere, a storm like a great beast with terrible teeth could not be denied. So the salesman jangled and clanged his huge leather kit, in which oversized puzzles of ironmongery lay unseen, but which his tongue conjured from door to door, until he came at last to a lawn which was cut all wrong. No, not the grass. The salesman lifted his gaze. But two boys, far up the gentle slope, lying on the grass. Of a like size and general shape, the boys sat carving twig whistles, talking of olden or future times, content with having left their fingerprints on every movable object in Greentown during summer past, and their footprints on every open path between here and the lake and there and the river since school began. "Howdy, boys!" called the man, all dressed in storm-colored clothes. "Folks home?" The boys shook their heads. "Got any money yourselves?" The boys shook their heads. "Well?" The salesman walked about 3 feet, stopped and hunched his shoulders. Suddenly he seemed aware of house windows or the cold sky staring at his neck. He turned slowly, sniffing the air. Wind rattled the empty trees. Sunlight, breaking through a small rift in the clouds, minted a last few oak leaves all gold. But the sun vanished. The coins were spent. The air blew gray. The salesman shook himself from the spell.
That's Christian Rummel reading from Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury, which is available commercially, although there are many other Ray Bradbury books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And is there a book you've read recently you'd like to recommend?
Well, I just finished listening to The Body by Bill Bryson, which is just fantastic. I'm a huge Bill Bryson fan. He takes these kind of enormous subjects and makes them totally memorable. He puts in the stories of people who discovered things and kind of their wacky lives. And I learned so much listening to Bill Bryson's stuff. So, The Body.
Long ago, when I was a junior high school student in America, I remember being taught by a biology teacher that all the chemicals that make up a human body could be bought in a hardware store for $5 or something like that. I don't recall the actual sum. It may have been $2.97 or $13.50, but it was certainly very little even in 1960s money. And I remember being astounded at the thought that you could make a slouched and pimply thing such as me for practically nothing. It was such a spectacularly humbling revelation that it has stayed with me all these years. The question is, was it true? Are we really worth so little? Many authorities, for which possibly read science undergraduates who don't have a date on a Friday, have tried at various times, mostly for purposes of amusement, to compute how much it would cost in materials to build a human. Perhaps the most respectable and comprehensive attempt of recent years was made by the Royal Society of Chemistry, when, as part of the 2013 Cambridge Science Festival, it calculated how much it would cost to assemble all the elements necessary to build the actor Benedict Cumberbatch. Cumberbatch was the guest director of the festival that year and was, conveniently, a typically sized human. Altogether, according to RSC calculations, 59 elements are needed to construct a human being. 6 of these, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, and phosphorus, account for 99.1% of what makes us. But much of the rest is a bit unexpected. Who would have thought that we would be incomplete without some molybdenum inside us, or vanadium, manganese, tin, and copper? Our requirements for some of these, it must be said, are surpassingly modest, and are measured in parts per million, or even parts per billion. We need, for instance, just 20 atoms of cobalt and 30 of chromium for every 999,999,999½ atoms of everything else.
The Body, written and narrated by Bill Bryson, is available from RNIB Talking Books or wherever you buy your audiobooks. And Bruce, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.